Gender Relations on the Moon.
This was a kind of utopian group that tried to create a way of being that would not lead to habitual violence. Their theory is that the violence that we see in most societies comes from patriarchy.
That's writer John Kessel, and this is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Later on, we'll talk with Elizabeth Strout about her new novel, Olive Kittredge. But first, speculative fiction writer John Kessel makes thought experiments about real issues by placing them in imaginary contexts. His latest collection of stories, The Bound Plan for Financial Independence, brings fantasy, science fiction, and magical realism to bear on the relations between the sexes, the conundrums of time travel, the windfalls of fortune, and terrorism. Kessel is the author of numerous stories, novels, and a play. He's a frequent contributor to the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, and he won the Nebula Award for his novella, An Other Orphan. Stories for Men, which appears in his latest collection, won the 2002 James Tiptree Jr. Award. Kessel teaches writing at North Carolina State University, and we talked to him when he was in town recently for a reading. Well, John Kessel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
The Bound Plan for Financial Independence is a collection of stories that range from fantasy, in the case of the title story, to speculative fiction, or in the case of what seems to almost be a novella called The Lunar Quartet, science fiction.
Oh, I think those are definitely science fiction stories, yes. So I'm interested in all those sorts of things. Anything that could roughly be called speculative fiction that covers the range from fantasy to science fiction to surrealism.
The Lunar Quartet is almost like a novella, as I said. It comprises several stories about a moon colony that was founded in the latter half of the current century. And the other stories range across different timelines or even times that may never exist or have existed. Is there a thematic connection between these stories of these separate genres in this book?
It's not something I set out to do when I wrote all of them, because I wrote them over a 10-year period. But yes, I think there are some real similarities. I think it's a matter of me being interested in certain subjects over that time period. And one of the ones that comes up again and again is relations between men and women and feminist issues, but also just things like marriage and parenthood and really, I'm just sort of very curious about, you know, how men and women come together and fall apart and what it is that they bring to each other and what is it that drives them away from each other. I'm very interested in that. I don't think it's a subject that can ever be exhausted.
You have a very original way of dealing with it. In fact, I'd like to concentrate on the Lunar Quartet. I mean, it's not the title story.
That's fine. No, I'm very proud of those stories. So yes, you know, the premise is that it's set in essentially a utopian colony that was founded in the later part of this century, as you say, and by both men and women, but having a rather alternative social structure in which women have more authority and power and men have less. And yet, also, men have more privilege than women.
So, yeah, and why did you make it that way? I found that a very interesting construction. I mean, men have more privilege. The idea of splitting privilege off from power, how did that come about?
Well, actually, one of the initial impulses was reading about the so-called pygmy chimpanzees or bonobos, if you know about them.
I was going to ask you about the bonobos.
I did a lot of reading about them. They recently, only in the last 30 years or so, have they been identified as a separate species from chimpanzees. At one point, they thought they were the same, but they're not. And they have a different setup. Chimpanzee culture, if you want to use that term, is patriarchal. And bonobo culture is matriarchal, and there are a number of significant differences. One thing, in a way, if there's conflict among chimpanzees, it's often resolved through violent confrontation. If there's conflict between bonobos, it's often resolved through sex. And so I thought, well, that would be interesting. What, suppose you tried to adopt or adapt those principles to a human society. And basically, well, the trade-off for men in this society is you have less political power, but you can have all the sex you want all the time, anytime you want it.
And is that kind of a paradise for the men, or is it a problematic for them?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to do is to show how it would be problematic for a whole lot of men, and not all of them. Some are quite happy with the situation, but then there are others who are unhappy, and they feel they deserve more more power, more authority, more ability to make political decisions in the society. And so the longest story in the quartet is called Stories for Men. It's about a 17-year-old boy who is a rabid fan of a stand-up comedian.
And he's a revolutionary hero.
But he is. He's sort of like Lenny Bruce or you know, maybe George Carlin in the sense that his comedy is very subversive. And he challenges the status quo in this female-dominated society. So he's a hero to this, my young protagonist, whose name is Erno. But I don't intend him to be a hero of the story. And I've actually had interesting reactions from both men and women on the story. A number of my feminist friends have asked me, well, how much do you intend to validate the opinions of this comedian, whose name, he adopts the name Tyler Durden, which is from the book Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I don't. I think he's not someone to emulate.
Describe a little bit more about what this society is like. You say in the book that it's a differentiated anarcho-social democracy. Could you explain that term?
You know, I don't know what that term means actually exactly, but the way I have the social setup in the stories is that families, there are no husbands, okay, or there are many husbands. Men can be with one woman for their whole lives, or they can have many women partners. Women can have many women partners. There is no prejudice against homosexuality in this culture. But by and large, men have no—they have no authority over children, for instance. Okay, and women have all of the rights and the duties and responsibilities of rearing children. Male children and female children are both educated, equally try to fulfill whatever talents they have educationally. But the difference is that girls are pushed to be independent. They come to the majority at the age of 14. So at what we consider a very early age, they're pushed out of the house. They can't live with their mom anymore, their aunt, and they're often these families that are extended, women families, the grandmother, the mother, the aunts, all living together with their children. But the girls are pushed out, and they have to find their way in the society, you know, get a job. They often will room together in apartments. They need to network. It's all about networking. It's all about the girls finding other women, other girls who they can form attachments with, which frequently will be their strongest attachments for the rest of their lives, and also finding female mentors. So the authority and status that a girl has or a woman has comes from her own initiative and her connections that she forges with other women.
All values that are traditionally in our culture seen as male values.
Right, right. Well, and conversely, the boys are coddled and treated given whatever they want. You know, there's one of the situations that Erno faces in his family is that he's got his own room. His sisters have to live in a share room, and he has more privileges, more material goods. And boys can live with their mom as long as they want.
I'm talking with John Kessel about his new collection of stories, The Baum Plan for Financial Independence. So say, why did the society come about the way it did? You make reference during the stories to the California Massacre without ever actually saying what it is. I mean, it's just mentioned. And there are two founders, as you said, a man and a woman. Say, what was the raison d'etre behind forming this society?
You know, I don't have this completely worked out, the history of it, but my vision of it is that this was a kind of utopian group that tried to create a way of being that would not lead to habitual violence. Their theory is that the violence that we see in most societies comes from patriarchy. They don't want to exterminate men. They don't want to give them no rights. They don't want to persecute them. But they want to figure a way so that men and women can live together more fulfillingly. And so that's their theory. And they originally set this up in California. They had a town or a compound, but they were faced a great deal of prejudice from the society around them. I conceive of that this sort of like some of the utopian communities that came to North America, like the Shakers or the Quakers or even the Mormons. They came and they had an alternative spiritual practice, but also an alternative social system. The Shakers had no mixing of the sexes, and or the Oneida community where you had practiced group marriage. Most of these communities lasted for a couple of generations at least, but then they tended to get overwhelmed by society around them, or they suffered a lot of persecution. So my future society, they call themselves the Society of Cousins, decided the only way they could survive would be to go far away from other human societies. So they decided to form this colony on the moon. And there are other colonies on the moon, many others that are more like Earth societies, but they decided to form their colony on the far side of the moon, very distant from any other human contact, and basically be self-sufficient and able to pursue their own social practices without interference.
And this idea of privileging the men and disempowering them, separating that privilege from power, and also separating sex from power. Is that really possible? Is it possible to separate power from sexuality?
I don't know.
And is that one of the things that you were thinking about?
Yes, and in some ways, writing these stories was not so much me making an advocating a change. It was actually more a thought experiment. Ursula Le Guin talks about this in her book, The Left Hand of Darkness, the idea that science fiction is a wonderful way to run thought experiments about alternative ways of being. And it's not that the writer knows how it's going to work out or how, is saying this is the way it should be, and we should all sign up for this plan. Far from it, frankly. I just thought I would try to imagine this alternative, and then I would try to make as much trouble for it as I possibly could. So every one of the stories presents a different problem. One of the other stories is about a girl who's 13 years old and is about to hit her majority, and she's extremely dissatisfied with her mother. And
also with the other girls, having trouble networking.
Right, exactly. She's a loner. She doesn't fit in with the other girls.
And this is an interesting story because she gets a man, a very low-status male, to help her escape, basically, from the retreat.
From summer camp, basically.
From summer camp, yeah, exactly. And I kept on thinking as I read that story, not really knowing if he was helping her because he was going to rape her.
Right.
Or whether, who was exploiting whom was the question.
Right, and of course, I played upon that. One of the things when you're reading the stories, you're wondering, well, what are his motives? Is he benign or is he really going to hurt her? I think that in a society like this, probably the worst crime you could imagine would be rape, okay? Not that rape isn't a terrible crime in our society, but it's the kind of male, power that is what they tried to get away from. So, I didn't intend him to be a negative character, but that would fit into, the guy would be at risk, and in fact, he is at risk. When he disappears with this 13-year-old girl, he's taking a risk to help her out. She asks him to do this, but of course, that puts him in a very untenable position in the society, and he's kind of rather dim-witted, actually, to let himself be used in this way. So that was one of the other things I thought I'd write about.
And the first story is about a father, Jack, a man from Earth,
right.
An immigrant from Earth, who accidentally kills his daughter Roz's stepbrother,
right.
the son of his... Jack's wife, basically, or
right.
paramour.
Right.
And there's more to that story in the sense that Roz, his daughter, and this stepbrother are also engaging or beginning a romantic relationship with
right.
each other.
Right. There's no taboo against that sort of thing.
Right. And when he kills him, he does it in a fit of you know, classic, almost the classic rivalry, the old man to
very male, yeah,
yeah, a really classic scenario, male scenario. But he's not a violent man. Could you talk about how you see male violence and how your view of that is expressed in this story and in this character of Jack?
Well, I have considerable sympathy for Jack, and he's reared on Earth in a society like ours, and so he's basically, you know, bought, his whole system, his whole history is like the history of a man of our time. And his wife really was basically incapable of taking care of their daughter, and so he steals his daughter away, and he ends up on the moon trying to get away. And he conceives of himself as a good father. He's trying to be a good father, trying to protect her. But the thing is, in this colony, there's no such thing as a father. Fathers are people who impregnate women and then they go away, and they have no. And any man who wanted to, you know, fulfill the role of a father, having some influence over his daughter's life, would be. It's very strange. Okay, so you know the idea of Jack committing this violent act. I agree with you. He didn't do this on purpose, but I did feel that violence is something that men are capable of. I don't know that, I know, are men more capable of violence than women? That's the question I don't know the answer to. Certainly it seems historically that men seem to commit more violence than women. Is that because of the social structures we have? Or is there something inherent in men that makes them more violent than women? And, you know, I don't know. If it is true that men are inherently more prone to violence than women are, then what do we do with that?
Exactly.
I don't know what we do with it. It's something that I think about a lot, actually. I think that men are not irredeemable. But I do think that, you know, there are things that we could do better.
And maybe it takes a society, a deliberately structured society, to do some of that. And one of those stories that really does explore those questions most fully, I think, is the one that you mentioned before, and that is Stories for Men, which I found a really beautiful story, one that I didn't want to end.
Thank you.
I kind of skipped over other stories in the book to continue the thread, because there is one later story that picks up the thread of that. It's a story about a developing resistance movement against some of the men, against what they see as their oppression. And you even call them masculinists,
right.
Like the feminists. So you talked about Tyler Durden. He's a comedian who's a subversive comedian, but he's something more than that. He's actually the head of a kind of conspiracy. And in some way, his seduces a follower, Erno, a young man of 17, who follows him but is not all that sure about him, but does get into trouble because of him. And there is a certain point where the question is posed to the community whether Tyler should be banished. Tell us what happens there. There's a meeting of the Society of Cousins, which is what this community is called.
Right. My idea of this is that this is not a dictatorship in any way. They have elected leaders. Women tend to be the only ones who vote. A man can get the franchise, but he has to give up all sorts of privileges in order to do that. But by and large, men don't do that. So, if you have a public meeting to decide some major issue, everyone is invited. Everyone is able to speak. It's sort of like a Quaker meeting where they go on and on and on talking about it. And some people are intelligent and stick to the issue, and other people are not. And one of the things I wanted to do with that scene was to show the broad range of opinions among the cousins. They're not all of one mind. And then they don't have capital punishment. They don't really have jails. What they do is they have a couple of levels of
ostracism.
Ostracism is their first level of punishment. And then finally, if someone just doesn't seem to them to be able to live within their society, they banish him or her to one of the other colonies on the moon. They have to make their own way at that point.
One of the things that they're discussing is the idea of free speech. I mean, that there's a free speech issue. Maybe give us a context.
Right.
Why is he being brought before this? What has he done?
Well, he's at one of his performances at a club, a riot started. And different people have different reasons for why they think the riot started. Some people think that there were too many police there, but others say, well, he's been aiming for this for a long time. His humor is too provocative. He's obviously trying to start a revolutionary movement, and he, you know, it's too dangerous to have him speak. Others say, no, we believe in free speech. He should have the right to talk in any way he wants. It's just the kind of thing that we have in our own society where we argue about what kind of speech is too provocative to allow. I tend to be a free speech absolutist, I think. So there's that problem. But the other thing is he basically has a belief that, you know, he wants to institute a kind of male, a mystique of maleness, you know, a mystique of the masculine, the power of maleness, and which has this whole society was sort of created to diminish that. Although they are very aware of, for instance, that men like to physically do. They have actually play violent sports in this place. They play ice hockey on the moon, and I go at some length showing how they're pretty brutal about it. But they want to channel those impulses into sports or into exploration or into discovery, scientific discovery. So men are, but they don't want men to channel this into, you know, having guns or having military groups or having a kind of organized male aggression.
We're speaking with fiction writer John Kessel about his new collection of stories, The Bound Plan for Financial Independence. One group of stories within the book, The Lunar Quartet, takes place in several colonies on the moon toward the end of the current century. One is a communitarian society dominated by women. Another is an uber-capitalist laissez-faire system. So here's where the ambivalence comes in. You said in the beginning of this interview that some feminist friends of yours think that you're too sympathetic with a Tyler Durden character. I found myself being sympathetic to him in the sense that when clearly the men are disempowered, and so they gain my sympathy. On the other hand, I also could, as a woman, and really as anyone with their eyes open in a society, could see why a society would want to protect itself against a man who elevated this male idea, because there is violence at the core of it.
Right. And I, again, it's a question I raised that I don't exactly know the answer to. I wanted to make him credible. I wanted to allow someone to read the story and say, well, he's got a point here, okay? You know, there is oppression. He doesn't have all the same rights as anyone else. He is speaking for people who are not being listened to. On the other hand, I also wanted to show that this has consequences that aren't necessarily good. And the thing that actually surprised me when I wrote the story was the role that Erno's mother takes in the story. Erno's mother is essentially a police officer. She's a constable. And Erno doesn't get along with her at all. He's rebelling against her as much as anything. And she keeps trying to keep him under control. And as I wrote the story more, I saw more of her point of view. She's seeing him be influenced by Tyler Durden, and she's worried about him. And one of the things that came to me as I was writing the story was the feeling of a parent who has a child who's doing risky behavior. I have a daughter who doesn't do risky behavior, fortunately. But at any rate, I that impulse to protect your child is very strong. And of course, that's also something that adolescents rebel against. They don't want to be controlled. They want to grow up. They want to have their, you know, and so they focus all of their rebellious energies against their parent. And so this is what's happening between Erno and his mother. And what I began to see is that from her point of view, she's a desperate woman. She's trying very hard to keep her son from doing something that's going to either make him the equivalent of a criminal or get himself killed. But he has no conception of that motivation of hers. As far as he's concerned, she's just trying to
control
squash
him. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you know, he's 17 years old and he doesn't see that side of it.
I remember those days when my son was 17.
So that was, to me, it was a very human story. And in the end it climaxes in a rather tragic, ending for Erno and his mother. not anything that either of them intended, and are certainly not what Erno intended. And it really is a horrible lesson he learns because he, you know, he didn't understand what was motivating her.
What is the lesson he's learning?
I think it's probably a lesson we all need to learn, is that despite our own feelings and our own justified anger and feeling of being oppressed, because I think we all have justified reasons for feeling that way. You know, we are oppressed in various ways. That's not the whole story. That there's more to it than that. That if we act only from our own self-righteousness, then we are capable of doing very bad things.
There's something you say in the book, or that Tyler Durden says in the book, that reminds me, that kind of rings a bell with what you're saying right now. And that is, he says that he puts out the idea that all sacrifice, and he's talking here about heroic sacrifice, is actually in the service to self. Right. In a way, he's kind of saying that the individual is more important than the collective.
Right.
Is that connected to this lesson that Erno lives?
I think it is, absolutely, because Tyler presents this very attractive vision of the absolutely independent, self-actuated male, okay, who is forceful and you know, makes his decisions and sticks by them and has integrity and all this other stuff. And it's really an attractive, I mean, it's John Wayne, okay? Tyler Durden is John Wayne. Okay, and I think that image has been very attractive to us. It still is attractive. Politicians try to be this guy in order to get elected in America today. And so what my feeling about that is that that's a cartoon. I guess I feel that we have a lot more obligations to each other than that image of the individual allows for.
There's another connection that I see in that. I mean, on the one hand, you have this society. In another story, Erno is now no longer part of the Society of Cousins, at least for a while.
Yeah, he gets banished.
And he is at the Mayor Colony, which is this kind of, I'm not even sure it's a caricature. It's kind of the free enterprise world, the Adam Smith laissez-faireism gone to an extreme.
Right.
This individualistic idea, is that part of the same contrast that you're making here?
Absolutely. That's something I wanted to do, is to put Erno in that world. He's really lived in a fairly communitarian society where everyone is encouraged to think about the effects of their own actions on other people. And here he goes to this place that is absolutely rugged individualism, social Darwinist, every man for himself. It's all about your ability to make your own way in the world and take care of yourself. And so I had some fun at the expense of that kind of ultimate capitalist vision of a utopia. That's another, some people think of that as a utopia. We should have that. And I don't tend to think that would work out too well. So actually, that story is really the beginning of another novel, which I haven't written yet, that is going to follow Erno's career after he leaves the Society of Cousins and ends with him returning. And I haven't finished writing it yet.
We're speaking with John Kessel, author of The Bound Plan for Financial Independence. It's just been published by Small Beer Press. Stay tuned for more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're speaking with John Kessel about his new collection of stories, The Bound Plan for Financial Independence. Kessel is a speculative fiction writer who uses the genres of fantasy, science fiction, and magical realism to think about what if. There's also a very curious story about time travel and Orson Welles.
Orson Welles, yeah.
And say out of what corner of your imagination that story came from.
Well, I'm very interested in history, and I'm very interested in movies. And actually, that story is one of a sequence that I've been writing over 15 or more years. The main character's name is Detlef Gruber, and he's a talent agent for a future Hollywood conglomerate. And what his job is to recruit new talent. But what he does is a future when time travel is available. It's very expensive, but it's available. He goes into the past to try to recruit famous actors or directors to bring back into the future to make films. And so this story is about him going back to 1941. Maybe it's 42. So it is 1942, excuse me. And it's right after Orson Welles made the movie The Magnificent Ambersons, which was a disaster and ruined his career in Hollywood, basically. No one went to it. The studio cut it to ribbons. And there's never been a complete print of The Magnificent Ambersons found ever since then. No one's ever seen the real movie. And so Detlef goes there to say to Welles, well, look, you know, this isn't working out for you right now. And frankly, I know what's going to happen to you for the next 40 years. It's only going to get worse. So you come with me and you make movies in the future. You're celebrated, famous, and you can avoid that future that you'll escape that horrible future that you're going to have. And so that's sort of the negotiation. Welles resists.
He does resist, and you have a kind of psychological theory as to why he resists, that there's a kind of a part in which he doesn't really feel like he deserves his success.
Well, many people have speculated about Welles was an immensely complicated man, and you know, he was a genius as far as making wonderful films. But he also was an egotist and insisted on doing things his own way. And often it seemed to many people around him anyway that he would almost deliberately court disaster. He would almost deliberately he'd antagonize people who had the money and the power. Mm-hmm. And that would that made it hard for him to succeed. And so in the story, I sort of speculate about that.
So say something about this time travel. You know, you talk about moment universes.
Right. That's a concept I came up with. I guess it's not completely original, but the terminology is all mine. And I wanted to create a form of time travel. See, one of the classic issues of time travel stories is if you go back into the past, the classic example is the grandfather paradox. You go back in the past and you kill your grandfather before he met your grandmother, then what happens to you? You will never be born. And I wanted to create a form of time travel where you could go back and kill your grandfather and then come back to the present and it would have no effect on you whatsoever. And so what I proposed was that every moment in time is quantized. It's a quantum. So that every moment is not connected to every other one. They're completely separate. So if you go back to 1201 on January 1st, 1950, and do something, you can do whatever you want at 1201. And if you go back again to 1202, it'll be as if you never were there.
It's a different universe.
It's a different universe. It's completely separate. And so that enables people to exploit the past ruthlessly in these stories. And one of the things I have a lot of fun with is the ways in which they do exploit the past and have no compunction about doing monstrously disruptive things to the past, so stealing the Mona Lisa many times. You can get it at 1201, you can get it at 1202, 1205, 1215, and 1230. So you can have as many copies as you're willing to go back and get it at different times. Or you can bring historical figures to the present. And yet, when you get back to the present, people still have a memory of them in history. They still lived their lives in your own history, but you've plucked them out of their own lives in the future history.
And I think that there is some kind of thinking among physics that the universe could be like this, the idea of, you know, alternate universes that are infinite in number.
Yep, there's a term called the many worlds quantum theory, which suggests that every moment, every quantum physics involves statistics, probabilities. Things will happen one way or happen another way. And the theory is that, well, for every statistical possibility where it goes one way or the other way also happens. And so that would branch off into another reality. And so there would be an almost infinite number of alternative realities.
What strikes me most about this concept is that it's very much like the authorial position. In other words, you know, if you can change, if you can travel back in time and change things just any way you want to, well, that's exactly what a novelist mm-hmm. would do, or a fiction writer.
Well, I hadn't really ever thought about it in exactly those terms, but it's true that authors have godlike powers. I think it's one reason we like to do this, is that we want to make the world the way we want it.
Could you say a little bit more about that? Maybe as a last, in the few minutes that we have left for this interview, talk a little bit more about that authorial godlikeness.
Well, it is interesting. I was talking to Gavin Grant at Small Beer Press about Flannery O'Connor earlier, and the idea that she was very took a godlike position towards her characters in her stories. If you read her stories, capricious and strange things happen to her characters, and she in her stories it's always because of the action of God. But I point out, well, it's not really God that's doing it; it's Flannery O'Connor. And I think that as we live in the world, we're always faced with at least it's something that it's very tempting to think about. You know, why do things work out the way they do? There's that book that says, why do bad things happen to good people? That's a fundamental question people have always asked. And so, you know, we ask about the God who allows this or causes these things to happen. Well, maybe fiction writing is a way of exploring that same impulse, that feeling of you know, what is it that's controlling the universe?
And how does that feel to you vis-a-vis your characters? I mean, I've talked to writers who say, oh, I don't know what I'm going to write. You know, it's almost as if the characters are writing themselves.
I don't know if I would go so far as to say that, but I do think that when you're working deeply in writing, you are intuiting things, and you're not controlling them. Like an architect building a building, there's some element of the architect building a building and writing a story. There's that rational process, but then there's also this sort of fumbling around in the dark or following a path with a flashlight, and you don't know where the path leads. You can only see 10 feet in front of you with the flashlight, and maybe it leads to the top of the mountain, or maybe it leads over a cliff, but you can only see the 10 feet in front of you, and that to me is a very interesting process. So the best stories, it seems to me, have to surprise the author a little bit too. If there's never anything that happens in your story that surprises you, then I think it's not likely to surprise anyone else. So it's not that I don't have a plan or will consciously change things, but there's also times when things surprise me. So what happened, for instance, to Erno's mother at the end of Stories for Men was not something I planned until I got to the end of the story.
And the book is The Baum Plan for Financial Independence. We've been talking with author John Kessel. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed this.
And you can hear John Kessel reading from the book, The Baum Plan for Financial Independence, and even download the book itself. Just go to writersvoice.net for the links. Next up, novelist Elizabeth Strout. Elizabeth Strout's new book, Olive Kittredge, uses the short story form to create a novel about the inhabitants of a coastal town in Maine. The central character, Olive Kittredge, shows up as a major or minor character in many of the stories, as the reader gets to see her from several points of view, that of herself, her family members, her neighbors, and former students. A teacher in the local school, she's known for her abrasive manner, but she's a complex personality with much compassion as well. Strout explores the complex humanity of all her characters as they evolve over time, revealing checkered depths of light and dark. Elizabeth Strout, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Your book, Olive Kittredge, this is a wonderful collection of stories that I would say focus around one main character, but not all of them do. They take place on the coast of Maine, yet they really explore an interior landscape that is completely universal. I didn't feel that they were
right
about coastal Maine.
Right.
But nonetheless, tell us a little bit about the setting within which these stories take place.
Well, I'm always interested in time and place and, you know, the character being a product of time and place. So the place is almost a character in the sense that this craggy coastline of Maine and the main character, Olive Kittredge, the central character, Olive Kittredge, comes from many generations of Maine on both sides of her family. And so she is a true Mainer, and that, I think, does have something to do with the development of her personality, I mean, or the development of her reactions to the world about her and to change and the different people that are coming into her town from out of town more and more. And so I'm very interested in how, you know, the world is changing and how these small towns in New England are changing. And Olive Kittredge sort of embodies a lot of that.
This is an unusual way of doing a work of fiction, some place between a novel and a series of short stories.
Exactly.
Could you talk a little bit about why you chose to do that?
Right. I from the very beginning, and I started with Olive Kittredge a number of years ago, I did write at that time one story. I think the first story was the one where her son is getting married for the first time and she steals her daughter-in-law's bra and shoe, I believe, during the reception. And that story, I think, was my first encounter with Olive. And I knew immediately that this was the woman who was going to have a full book. There would be a book of Olive. And I think I also understood rather intuitively and rather early on that it wouldn't take the form of a traditional novel with any kind of linear beginning and end, because I saw her as such a forceful figure that I think I sort of understood the reader would need a break from her and that it would be very interesting to see her role in the community and to see her character from different people's points of view, which always interests me anyway, how we see only from our own point of view. And so I was very interested to give the reader glimpses of her from other points of view. But at the same time, it does, for me, it feels that it is a novel. It has the heft of a novel. It is the story of this woman's life.
And say more about Olive. You say she's a very strong character. That's certainly true. And also a character with many different aspects, many of which really only become fully realized in the reader's eye as the book progresses.
Right. That's right. And that's another reason that point of view, I think, you know, to tell the tale of other people in the town and to have Olive make her entrance sometimes in a larger way, sometimes in a smaller way, helps the reader to see Olive in many different lights, because I think that that's how we are all seen. We're, you know, the people that we're closest to think we see, you know, we think that we see them and they see us in a big way and a more understanding way. It's not always true. You know, it takes a lot of different snapshots for, you know, to begin to get any sort of understanding of what is a personality, what is a character.
And did that happen for you with her?
Yes, absolutely. In this story, Starving, I think, where she comes across that girl who is ill and has such an immediate and compassionate and very open response to her, that, you know, it took me a little bit by surprise as I was writing it. It was nothing planned out. It's not that I plan out very much of these stories or any of my work, but I was sort of surprised and happy about seeing Olive respond that way to that young girl.
And in fact, responds with great compassion, not only to that young girl, but also in another story that's early on in the book.
Right, to the young man, yeah.
There's a young man who comes home to do away with himself. That's in the story, Incoming Tide.
Right.
And that's really the first time you get an idea of Olive as somebody who is quite deft and perceptive.
Yes, exactly. And that she's actually, I mean, it's certainly up to the reader to take whatever experiences they bring to that story and interpret it however they want to, but I think that there is the opportunity there to see that Olive is, you know, she's no dope, this woman, and she's playing this very, in many ways, very straightforwardly, and in another way, very carefully.
Tell us more about her. For listeners who haven't read the book yet, how would you like to introduce Olive to them?
Well, I think she's a real piece of work, I think. And I think that, you know, many readers have said, oh, she just irritated me so much, but then I ended up, like, loving her. And so I'm glad to hear that response because I certainly spent a lot of time with her. And I think, you know what, I think she says all the things that some of us don't ever want to say and never will say. And I think that she behaves in ways that are pretty poor and pretty obstreperous at times, and yet there's something about her, there's some element of deep humanity underneath all that crustiness and underneath all her irritations, and I think she's just quite ferocious in her emotions and in her needs, and she's sort of goes and gets what she needs without too much apology, and yet she does, even much later on in her life, she is still open to learning and evolving.
And she actually even says at some point later in the book that she suddenly realizes how desperately most people are working to get what they need.
That's right. That's right. And that would certainly include Olive.
We're talking with novelist Elizabeth Strout about her most recent work of fiction, Olive Kittredge. She's also the author of Abide With Me, a national bestseller, as well as other books and short stories. You know, there's another minor character in the book who even doesn't really come out much but reminds one of Olive and yet does not have her depth or compassion. It's in a story, the one in which a man develops this relationship with Daisy.
Harmon, yeah.
Harmon. That's
the hardware store owner, Harmon. That's the story called Starving, yes, where the young girl is ill in that.
That's right, and his wife is a kind of a paler version of Olive Kittredge. Could you say something about the two in contrast? I mean, is it just that his wife is not somebody you wanted to discover, or do you think she also has the same depths, or is she just not a very nice person?
Well, I think that we're not really entirely sure, because that story explores It's Harmon's story, really. It's Harmon's story of a male version of the empty nest. You know, his sons have grown. He's left feeling much more bereft than he expected to, with the kids gone, and he doesn't really understand. You know, he thought maybe his wife would be the one with the empty nest problems, but in fact, she seems to be doing quite well, and she's quite active in this net. So I think that it's really Harmon's story, but the aspect of that wife's standoffishness, I think that we really don't know what her particular point of view is in that. And at the risk, and it's a genuine risk, of talking again about time and place, there is a certain quality at times in New England of a taciturn nature. And I'm very interested in a region of the country where people are not necessarily all that comfortable talking about their interior lives. And so I think that I see Bonnie, Harmon's wife in that story, as someone who has not really, she's not necessarily been raised in that way. She's had a bunch of boys, they've gone and left. She's been, we assume, a good mother to them. So she's not necessarily, because of who she is and where she lives and what her entire cultural background is, somebody who's necessarily going to be able to share with her husband at that point in her life what's going on. And it's very sad.
He, in fact, falls in love with somebody not because of the sexual attraction between them. I mean, he's a middle-aged man.
Right.
He's not particularly attractive himself, and neither is... is his, I can't really say
Daisy,
it on the
right.
air, his blank buddy.
Right, right.
But he falls in love with her because he is able to begin to reveal himself and her to him. Could you talk more about that process and how did that plot development come to you?
Yeah, that was very interesting to me. I didn't really plan on that. Like I said, I don't have a very conscious idea when I sit down. I did, you know, I saw Harmon in that first scene sitting there admiring this youthful couple and feeling, you know, the sadness of the loss of his children having grown. But he doesn't know that he's headed for any particular crisis. And so as I unfolded the story, I began to understand, which I've often thought anyway, that talking, because when he starts to talk with Daisy, when they stop briefly their sexual affair and just decide, you know what, we're just going to talk, that's when they really do fall in love. And I've often thought that talking is actually very sexy, and that talking is a powerful thing, and particularly in this region and this situation where this man simply did not have, you know, once the commotion of having four boys in the house goes away, then one really hopes and needs or would assume that there'd be a chance for real conversation, but in that case there's not. And so it's the talking, it's the sharing of the, you know, the childhood. You know, we all want to be seen. We all want somebody to know those little details about us that that nobody else really knows about or cares about. And that's powerful.
And that's what really makes us feel loved.
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
Now, it seems that you really dive down into the interior life. Kind of, you remind me as an author of Persephone, kind of going where few will go into the land of Hades, but there was such a compassionate heart. I mean, I found myself, I have to admit it, I found myself weeping at some of these stories.
Many people have said that, yeah.
My guest is Elizabeth Strout. We're talking about her latest book, Olive Kittredge. Now, Olive ages through the book. You follow her into her 70s. Could you talk about how does she develop in this way? What are her accommodations with life?
Right. Well, certainly during that time period, she suffers losses, as we do. You know, the accumulation of losses is something that one can truly shudder about if we think about it too much. We don't want to think about our lives that way. We want to think that we continue to gain, whether it's, you know, Harmon wanting his grandchildren, or, you know, that there's an abundance to life that is wonderful all the time, or perhaps available all the time. But Olive is going through losses. She loses her son first to the first wife, and then the wife moves him away, which astonishes her because, again, at this time and place, it's not unreasonable for Olive, or at least she doesn't feel that it's unreasonable for her to think that her son will stay right there, because at that time and place, many people did stay right where they were born, and he had a nice setup, and he had his parents, and he was really kind of supposed to stay there, but off he goes to the other side of the country, then gets divorced, and then gets remarried, and ends up in New York City, and so this is a tremendous loss for her. It's her only child, and then, of course, she loses Henry first to a stroke, and then ultimately to death, and so the bafflement of having been someone who has been, you know, she was a teacher, she was in charge of a classroom, she was in charge of her family, she was kind of in charge of her husband, she was certainly in charge of her son, and this is all taken away from her bit by bit by bit in her particular aging process. And now you know from having read the book that she's going to actually be able to handle this ultimately. But it's a difficult, difficult ride for her, because she, I think, like most of us, we, you know, these are abstract ideas of loss until they really hit. And then it's sort of like, oh, you know, what do we do? What are we going to do? And then, of course, when I say that abundance is always available, I think that, you know, she understands that there is ultimately a choice to be made.
A choice?
Well, a choice to either to live in isolation or to join forces with other people.
You mentioned her son. There are a number of stories in which the relationship between them appears, but the two central ones are Little Burst, which is his first marriage, and
right.
then Security,
right.
which in some ways I found that was one of the most powerful in the book for me. In this, her son gets to tell her
right.
how he sees her.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit, how he sees her, how she takes it, the dynamics of that interrelationship.
Yes, that was a very... That was quite, I guess in a certain way, that's sort of my favorite story, or I feel most affection toward that story or whatever, but it's again, it shows the complicatedness of Olive and her relationship to her son. She goes to New York to visit her son, who has married somebody with two children, and he's about to have his own child with this new wife, and she's sort of hopeful and optimistic after first arriving there, even though she's not particularly charitable in her thoughts about the new daughter-in-law, but that's Olive. But nevertheless, she's beginning to think that this is going to go in a certain kind of way. And then it's just by that small act of finding out that she's dribbled ice cream down her and that her son and daughter-in-law haven't told her, that she feels humiliated. And so this one little act becomes, in her mind, huge and emblematic of the fact that she does feel humiliated. She feels that they have dissed her, you know, by not sharing with her. You know, it makes her feel old. It makes her feel out of control. And then she begins responding the way we assume she has sometimes in the past, because Christopher, who has had therapy, tells her things in a whole different kind of language than she's ever heard him speak before, and it's just crushing and very baffling and very, very frightening to her. And it's quite a story, I think, in a certain way.
There was so much truth being said there.
Yes.
Between them.
Yes.
And it was such a shock, really, for her. And I wasn't even quite sure. I mean, he's had therapy, and she kind of looks upon that suspiciously.
Right.
Oh, I see. That's why he is being able to talk to me that way.
Right.
But for him, you sense that it's a real healing.
Right.
And yet I wondered if there was a point, had he yet reached a point where he could be compassionate? Was he really seeing her fully, or just seeing one side of her?
Exactly. I think that's a very good question, and it's, you know, it's raised and not directly answered. Again, I think every reader brings to it what they, you know, bring of their own life's experiences, which is why, to a certain extent, all these stories would be different stories for different readers to some extent. And I think that, you know, I was very, very conscious of not, I'm not interested in choosing sides. I'm not interested in who's right and who's wrong. I mean, the behavior in that story is, from an objective standpoint, deplorable on both sides. And yet, I wasn't interested in taking sides at all, just interested in saying, oh, my God, look what we do to each other. Look what we do when we're frightened. Look what we do when we're angry. Look what we do when we're confused. Look at how well we can hide from ourselves the pain we inflict on others.
Exactly. And you yourself, I mean, I felt at that point I could feel your compassion for all of us in a way.
Yeah.
You know, just in that sense, look what we do, and none of us intend to do it.
No, we don't.
For those
and
reasons.
Most of us really don't. You know, we're just sort of doing the best we can and you know, kind of making little messes as we go, and that's life.
And is that the sense that you feel is at the heart of your work?
Yeah, I can't really necessarily put into words, but I'll try. I love people. I really love people. I've always found people fascinating. And they break my heart. I love them, and I think they're so brave, and I think they're cowardly, and I just, you know, so human behavior has just always been the most interesting thing to me, and in a very moving way. And so, as a storyteller, I'm telling stories about what I see as what it means to be human.
Novelist Elizabeth Strout. Her new novel is Olive Kittredge, and you can hear an excerpt of her reading from it by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Next week, we talk with acclaimed novelist Paul Auster about his new book, Man in the Dark. And we also talk with fiction writer Jennifer Haig about her new novel, The Condition. For more information about Writer's Voice, go to writersvoice.net. You can get our podcast there and listen to archive shows. Thanks for listening. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.